I'm going to turn to the book of Proverbs. We'll be looking there tonight, chapter 26. I'll give you something to study. We know the Bible is not contradictory of itself, but if we look at verses 4 and 5 of the book of Proverbs in chapter 26, there appears to be a confusion that I haven't been able to reconcile yet. Verse 4 says, "Answer not a fool according to his folly, lest thou also be like unto him." But verse 5 says, "Answer a fool according to his folly, lest he be wise in his own conceit." So it seems as though what the proverb writer may be trying to tell us is, when you come up against a fool in an argument, you're going to lose no matter what. If you answer him according to his folly, you're going to be considered just like him. But if you don't answer him, he's going to think he got the better of you. So in other words, there's some folks that you argue with that you just can't win. And that's the best I can figure from those two, because it seems as though one says answer not a fool according to his folly, the other one says answer a fool according to his folly. And both of them tell you, whichever way you do it, you're going to come out on the short end of the stick. So maybe you've known some folks like that. I've certainly known some folks that it didn't do any good to try to reason with them at all. They just were unreasonable, I guess. So those two verses were of interest. I've got them marked in my Bible with question marks beside them, because I'm just not sure how to, when you come up against a fool, you just don't have any way out that's going to be a pleasant alternative. But down in verse 11, he talks a little bit more about the fool. He says in verse 11, "As a dog returneth to his vomit, so a fool returneth to his folly." And you know, that's sometimes it seems that way with all of us, though. It seems like we feel kind of like Paul did in Romans chapter 7, that the good thing that I want to do, I don't do, and the bad thing that I don't want to do, that's what I wind up doing. It's like I just go back and do the same thing, even though I don't want to do it. And the writer of Proverbs here says that a fool goes back to his folly again and again. Hopefully, if we can train ourselves and teach ourselves to not be fools, perhaps we can get out of that cycle of going back and repeating the same mistakes again and again. But it's not easy. The natural tendency of human beings is to fall back into the same patterns. My wife, when she was in school, in high school, had a teacher who was a kind of like psychology or sociology class. And the teacher didn't have a seating chart. You know, a lot of teachers put the kids in a certain seat according to their name or whatever. Well, this teacher didn't. He said, "Well, I know that people," from his study of psychology and sociology, just the way that people's behavior was, he said, "I know that pretty much where you come in and sit down the first day of the year, you're going to sit in that same seat every day the rest of the year." And it's true. We see it here at church. We've got our pew, and we sit on our pew. And most of us even have a spot on our pew that if we're sitting switched around with the person next to us, we just feel like we're in the wrong place. But that's human nature to some degree, is to follow a tradition or a pattern. And it's a bad thing when that pattern that's being followed is a pattern of folly. How many people I've talked to who had trouble with drugs or alcohol or sexual problems with the opposite sex, or for that matter with the same sex, and they know that those things that it shouldn't be that way, but "I'm going to do better," and they may do better for a few days, but they get right back into that same pattern. It is hard to break habits. That's why it's so important. We talked about this morning with the young people. It's so important to teach the young people and get them having good habits from the start. because it's a whole lot easier to keep those good habits than it is to break bad habits and try to start good habits. It's a hard thing to do. But as the dog returns to his vomit, and dogs will do that, okay, that's, we think that's awful, but that dog, that's what dogs do. He says a fool returns to his father. So important for us to teach the young people and for us to work diligently and always keep it in our mind that that temptation is going to be there to go back to that sinful behavior. Because it's when we let our guard down that Satan gets us. In verse 20, he says, where no wood is, there the fire goes out. Well, it doesn't take a genius to figure that one out. But, you know, you didn't have to have the wisest man in the world to tell you if there's no wood, the fire's going to go out. But he also then puts this side of it there as well. So, or in the same way, where there is no tale bearer or gossip, the strife ceases. Is that the truth? And we said, well, it doesn't take a genius to figure that out either. Well, maybe not, but boy, we need to practice it. We need to quit gossiping. We are constantly keeping fires going and keeping strife stirred up when we gossip. And the strife would cease, there would be peace. Now, most of us, if we were asked, we would say, yeah, I like peace. I like harmony. I like things to be easy and to get along with folks. Most of us would say that. But our behavior tells a different story, because when we gossip and tell stories on folks, that's not the way to produce peaceful relationships. It's going to cause strife. Where there's no talebearer, strife ceases. Then, down in verses 24 and 25, it says, he that hates dissembles with his lips, and layeth up deceit within him. When he speaks fair, believe him not, for there are seven abominations in his heart. You've probably known those folks that hate you, despise you, but they'll be so sickly sweet to your face. And he says, when he speaks fair, don't you believe it. He's got seven abominations hidden in his heart. For every good word he says, he's thinking seven horrible thoughts in his mind about you. That's the way somebody who's, we could say they're two-faced, but that's the way a lot of people are. They won't tell you how they actually feel about you or what they actually think. They'll hide it, and they'll be just as kind and just as sweet. And then there'll be that tale-bearer that we talked about in the verse before, and they'll go tell everybody in the world everything else bad about you they can think of. And then they do the same thing to those people. You got to be careful. Chapter 27, we're gonna see a couple things that go back to that just a minute. But first, in verse 1, boast not thyself of tomorrow, for thou knowest not what a day may bring. That sounds a lot like something that James wrote in the New Testament. He said, go to now, ye that say, today or tomorrow we'll go into the city and we'll do such and such for a city, and then we'll... Yeah. You know not what lieth on the morrow. He says, but you should say, if the Lord will, we will live and do such and such. But we need to understand that idea of boasting, bragging about what we're going to do, and I'm going to do this, and I'm going to do that. You don't even know if you're going to wake up tomorrow. And we might say, I'd like to do this, and I'd like to do that, and I want to do this, and I want to do that, and I hope I can do this, and, you know, and those kinds of things. But we don't know. Not always. But sometimes we make statements of our intention. You know, I imagine a couple weeks ago on Wednesday night, I probably told most all of you I'd see you Sunday. Well, I didn't. I didn't see any of you last Sunday. I was homesick all day. But it was my intention to be here. That was my plan. That was what I was expected to do and to have happen. But our plans don't always come through the way we expect them to. And we need to keep that in mind and not be boastful. And it's not always, you know, just saying, well, I'll see you Wednesday or I'll see you Sunday. I don't think that's boasting. I think that's just sharing with others our intention, what we intend to do if we live and if we're able. But we've got to watch the arrogant attitude that sometimes we take, because we've got to realize that we're not in total control of what happens in our lives. There are many things that happen, and of course God may not allow certain things to take place. Verses 5 and 6 now speak back to the last chapter in verses 24 and 25. Here he says, open rebuke is better than secret love, and faithful are the wounds of a friend, but the kisses of an enemy are deceitful. Sometimes we like the flattery and the nice things that are said, the sweet things that are said, so much. And we think that if anyone corrects us, or rebukes us, or points out any fault with us, that they're our enemy, and we don't like those people. But the fact of the matter is, the Bible tells us that it's better to have that faithful friend wound us with the truth than it is to be getting all of that flattery from all of those people who are like the fellow back in verses 24 and 25 of the last chapter. Really hate us, but they're putting on a show, pretending. Paul asked the question, have I become your enemy because I tell you the truth? The fact of the matter is, if we love someone, if we are a friend to them, we're going to tell them the truth, and we're going to correct them. And sometimes, love must be tough. And sometimes it hurts to hear the truth, especially when it's something that we didn't want to admit to ourselves. But I've been there, and I'm better off for all of the people who pointed out the faults and rebuked me and corrected me than I've ever been for any of the false compliments that were paid. Put all those false compliments, all of that flattery, you can pour it by sack full, and it will never do you a bit of good. Oh, it sounds pleasant to the ear at the time, but it doesn't accomplish anything of any good. And then he says, open rebuke is better than secret love. You know, it's better to have somebody come out and confront you and correct you and rebuke you for doing something wrong than it is to have somebody who loves you and won't tell you. How many times, gentlemen, have you had your zipper down in public? Yeah, it happens. Now, what's better, the person who loves you and knew it was down but didn't say anything, or the one who said something to you so you could correct the problem? Now, ladies, if you ever had, you know, you had your dress caught in your pantyhose, or, I mean, you know, those things happen and they're embarrassing, but isn't it better when somebody says, hey, I want to go back in the bathroom and fix that? There's been times where I had something on my face, or, you know, maybe at a fellowship meal or something, had something on my face for a couple of hours before somebody finally said, you know, you got something right there. And I'm thinking, all those other folks had to have seen that and didn't say a thing about it. Why didn't they say something? Well, that's the open rebuke. You know, we think, oh, well, I don't want want to embarrass them and hurt their feelings by telling them it's there. But how much more embarrassing is it to not say anything and let them keep on going like that? That's embarrassing. So, these are silly things. These are things of no real consequence. But how much more so when we're dealing with matters of sin or matters of salvation? How much more important then does it become? Well, I love them too much to tell them that they're wrong. I love them too much to tell them that it's a sin to do such and such. Oh, if you love them, tell them. Open rebuke is better than secret love. You need to be open about it. The wounds of a friend are faithful. They're true. They're good for you. They benefit you. But not the kisses of the enemy. They'll deceive you into thinking everything's all right when it's not. Then verse 14. I've thought of this one on a few occasions, usually early in the morning. He that blesseth his friend with a loud voice rising early in the morning, it shall be counted a curse to him. And it's not just early in the morning, but, you know, if somebody's asleep and you wake them up in the middle of their sleep before it's time for them to get up, even if you call them to wish them happy birthday, they're not going to be too happy. They're going to take that as a curse. Now this, of course, was, you know, can you imagine? We have this happen sometimes when we lived in the apartment, and I know any of you who've ever lived in an apartment, you know how this. Maybe you have a neighbor that in the middle of the night be hollering, or some of their friends will come and show up and, "Hey, buddy, how you doing? I didn't see you." It's the middle of the night. That's counted as a curse. Even if, you know, if you're a friend, you know, keep your voice down. Come at a better time to visit. And I know we see that, but he sure, that certainly, you know, even if it was a blessing with a loud voice early in the morning, don't call me at 5 o'clock in the morning to wish me a happy birthday, okay? I mean, it'd be much happier if you let me sleep till 7, you know? I mean, just don't do that kind of thing. And these are things, you know, Proverbs, that's what Proverbs, you know, things that they're amusing sometimes, but it fits just so much with human nature. We'll do that somehow. The same thing might be said, on the other hand, of somebody who calls somebody late at night. You know, I always make it a policy, and I don't know what hours everybody's up or down or sleeps or what, but other than the people who I know certain people, you know, when they're up and not, so forth. But for the most part, I don't call anybody after 9 o'clock at night. I'm not going to call them any later than that because I know a lot of folks go to bed by then. Some folks may go to bed even earlier than that. But I'm not going to call any later than that. This is not much worse than getting a call at, you know, midnight or 1 o'clock in the morning. In my occupation, when I get a call at that time of the night, the first thing I think is somebody died. Something bad has happened. Now, I used to be used to that because my parents used to call at that time of the night all the time because that's the only time they'd get us. But we told them, "We got kids now. Try to go to bed a little earlier. Don't call so late." But you know, we don't particularly care for that. That's not a pleasant thing to be woken up with a phone call or with somebody ringing the doorbell or whatever the case may be. Then verse 20, and we'll close with this one. Verse 20, he says, "Hell and destruction are never full. So also the eyes of man are never satisfied." I've been reading some of Grimm's fairy tales, you know, Cinderella, Little Red Riding Hood, and so on and so forth. But one of the stories was about this couple that they were just humble little fishermen and his wife. But so there was, you know, as usual, there's some magic involved, and this magic fish is able to grant him a wish. And well, the first wish is they want a better house. and they're satisfied with that for one night. The next day, no, go back down there and get a better wish, and we want a castle. And then they're not satisfied with the castle and all the servants, and they want to be king. And then before the story ended up, you know, I want to be like God. Isn't that just where it started? Remember in the Garden of Eden? What did Eve get told by the serpent? God knows that you'll be like Him if you eat this. Never satisfied. We can't be satisfied with being made a little lower than an angel. We gotta be equal to God. Of course, when they went back and made that wish, they got stuck back in their little shack. But, you know, that's the way we are. And we have to fight hard against that nature. To always be looking for something else. I want more. That's not enough. The eyes of man are never satisfied. Now, you know, when we think about man, you know, that doesn't let y'all off the hook, women. The word man there is the humans, human beings, all of us. That's the way we are. Never satisfied. We can change that. Jesus can help us to change that. But we won't change it on our own. We've got to have a change of heart. We've got to have a turnaround in our life. If you're here and you have a need to respond to the invitation, perhaps one of these has brought to light a problem that you have in your life that you need to work on. Whatever your need might be, we ask that you respond as we stand in it.